Alex Amon, your non-binary host, and this is the 53rd episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today I'll talk about the provisional government, the anti-treaty side, and why the treaty was so unacceptable. Exciting announcements first. One, I have posted several different behind-the-scenes videos exploring my writing, research, and recording process. And you can watch them by joining my Patreon. Join $2 a month and get access to all the behind-the-scenes videos, special episodes, and access to my podcast episodes earlier than anyone else. All donations help me run this podcast and allow me to expand upon my research and try new formats and platforms. The second announcement is I have a personal goal, because this is our third season and the third year of doing this. I would love to get to 30 patrons by the end of the year. I think it's doable. It would be really awesome if we could do it, even if it's just $1 a month, $2 a month, every little bit counts. And then the third announcement is I have a TikTok account. It is AOA Warfare. And right now I am upsetting nationalists by calling Enver Pasha a piece of shit, and answering questions about how did the Russian language get to Central Asia, and was communism a psyop by the World War I German generals to destroy the Tsarist Empire. So join us over on TikTok, ask me a bunch of questions. We're having a great time over there. And now that the betting for money part is over and the announcement part is over, it's time for making history. I know a lot is happening right now, and I'm excited about the writer's strike, the actor's strike, the Teamsters strike, the UPS strike. I think some automotive workers are going to go on strike. I hope the VFX artists go on strike. Like, please, just strike away, guys. But today, I want to talk about something that's a little bit more somber, and that is the Stop Cop City effort. So first, it's still going on, and people in Georgia are fighting like crazy to protect not only their own forest and their own communities, but all of us. And so there are three ways we can help. First, Victor Portas is an indigenous water protector who was arrested for protesting Top City. He was released 3 months after his arrest on bond, but then fucking ICE picked him up. He is now in Stewart Detention Center in Georgia, a notorious prison that is run by Core Civic, one of the largest private prison corporations in the world. So last time I checked, he's still in that prison and he still needs our help. We need to call ICE at 404-893-1290 and demand his release. He needs to know we are out there fighting for him. So you can send him letters at Victor Portas, P-U-E-R-T-A-S, 0956-10252-6B-215B, P.O. Box 248, Lumpkin, Georgia 31815. And don't worry, I will put that address in the description. You can also send him money via money order at Core Civic Portes Victor, 615-330, Facility, all caps, STWRT, P.O. Box 16545, Atlanta, Georgia, 303210545. And again, I will put that in the description. After you do that, call your representatives, especially your Democrats, and you tell them to pressure Biden to keep his word and cancel all 287G contracts. 287G contracts are Trump-era legislation that allows ICE to deputize police to act as ICE agents. We need them to cancel the fucking contract and defund ICE. Then you will call the White House and tell Biden the same thing. And then you call Secretary Mayorkas and you tell him to cancel the ICE contracts. Never Again Action has a petition you can sign, which I'll include in the description, demanding Biden and Mayorkas to cancel the contract. Never Again Action is also working with a number of partners to do bigger protest movements and, you know, like mailer campaigns. So find a local cell in your, wherever you live, and help join the fight against ICE. Because if ICE didn't exist, or if ICE hadn't deputized the police, Victor Portas wouldn't have been handed over to ICE. So the second thing you can do to help is The people of Atlanta came together and launched a ballot referendum to let the people of Atlanta decide if Cop City should be built or not. They have less than 60 days to collect 70,000 signatures of registered voters in Atlanta. If you are in or near Atlanta, the organization Vote to Stop Cop City is looking for canvassers. I'll post the sign-up sheet in the description. If you are not in Atlanta but have friends in the state, call them and tell them to mobilize their friends and sign the petition. The organization is also trying to raise $140,000 to help them with their work. I'll post the donation link in the description. After the ballot is approved, it will be added to the ballot on November 7th, 2023. That means that if we work together, we can stop Cop City this year. Finally, the ballot is an important tool, but we know the best way to stop anything in this capitalist hellscape is to target the source of money. The website stopcopcitysolidarity.org, which I'll post the link to in the description, has a list of corporations who are funding Cop City. The main targets are Nationwide Insurance. They're insuring the building of Cop City. If they pulled out, construction would have to stop. You can call their VPs, Amy Shore at 614-249-9686 and Raymond Jones, 614-249-7391, and tell them to pull out of the Cop City. Stop insuring it. The second target is Braysfield and Gorey, the local contractors. So if they pull out, no one's building anything. You can call them at 678-581-6400. Finally, the third main target is Cadence Bank, C-A-D-E-N-C-E. They are providing a $20 million loan to build Cop City. You can call their CEO, James Dan Rollins, at 662-680-2008. You can call their president, Chris Badley, 662-680-2209. And you can call their chief communications officer, Danielle Cornell, at 713-817-4051. And also at 713-392-7709. If you're calling the bank, tell them to take back the loan. There are also additional targets such as Bank of America, Home Depot, UPS, Delta Airlines, Merrill Lynch, Trust Bank, Wells Fargo, Target, Chase Bank, AT&T, and Chick-fil-A. If you have a membership or an account with any of those organizations, cancel them now. And when you cancel, tell them it's specifically because they are supporting Cop City and you don't want to work with a company that supports Cop City. If I said those numbers too fast or the names of the corporations, don't worry. I'll put all the information in the description and you can also check out the website, stopcopcitysolidarity.org. The website has a number of activities, has numerous action ideas as well as guides on how to plan your action and how to like call these companies, what to say. Please check out their website and plan an action today and be sure to tag them on social media so they know that they're not fighting this alone. And now, time to discuss the provisional government and the anti-treaty side. What should have been a cause for celebration, the ratification of the Anglo-Irish Treaty ending 800 years of British dominance, was the final strike needed to shatter the Irish Republican movement. Eamon de Valera, president of the Dáil and leader of the Irish Republican movement, so incensed by the ratification of the treaty, renounced his presidency and led a number of Dáil members out in protest. Arthur Griffith was elected the new Dáil president, and 7 days later, Michael Collins was named chairman of the provisional government. Griffith and Collins, who spearheaded the efforts to negotiate the Anglo-Irish Treaty, were now responsible for handling the transition from being a British colony to a British dominion, and prevent a civil war. Part 1. Transition of Power. During the Dáil debates, Colin described the Anglo-Irish Treaty as a quote-unquote stepping stone towards Irish independence. I would tweak that slightly by calling it a series of stepping stones, the first one being the creation of the Provisional Government of Ireland. But what was the Provisional Government? The Provisional Government was created by Article 17 of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. It was meant to be a temporary government to handle the transition from being a purely colonized nation to the Irish Free State. Once a constitution was passed, the provisional government would step down for the constitutionally sanctioned government of the Irish Free State. The provisional government would go through two different leaders. The first government was led by Collins, and it lasted from January 14th until the June general election, which elected the second provisional government. This was led by William Cosgrave, Minister of Home Affairs, and ruled until the approval of the Irish Constitution on December 6, 1922. Despite being created by the treaty, Britain did not actually confer any powers to the provisional government until April 1922. Additionally, the provisional government was supposed to be answerable to a House of Parliament, but did not specify a specific parliament or even create one, and the British government had never recognized the Dáil. So technically, the provisional government was kind of in this legal no man's land, which would be really important later during the Civil War. The first provisional government consisted of the following members: Michael Collins as chairman, Eamon Duggan as Minister for Home Affairs, W.T. Cosgrave as Minister for Local Government, Kevin O'Higgins as Minister for Economic Affairs, Fionnan Lynch, Minister for Education, Patrick Hogan as Minister for Agriculture, Joseph McGrath as Minister for Labour, J.J. Walsh as Postmaster General. While Britain did not acknowledge the Dáil as a legitimate form of government, Ireland was ruled by both the provisional government and the Dáil. The Dáil consisted of a president, Arthur Griffith, and his own cabinet. The provisional government technically was not answerable to the Dáil until a new election was called. This election would be held in June, and they took their oath in September 1922. This is where this myth of like the second Dáil and the third Dáil come in. I think we'll get into this a little more next episode when we talk specifically about the IRA. But if you research like the provisional IRA, especially in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they will always argue that they were never dismissed because the second Dáil was never ended. The second Dáil was the Dáil of the Republic. It belonged to De Valera. It couldn't be undone by the provisional government or even an election or the treaty or the constitution because they had no power. They were illegitimate forms of government. And so you have this mythical second Dáil that never was disbanded, and everyone who was part of Sinn Féin was supposed to be continuing that tradition of being in the second Dáil, and the IRA was supposed to like be answerable to the second Dáil, and so every Dáil that followed was illegitimate. Still, both the Dáil and the provisional government worked closely, since many of the ministers served in both governments. The dual government structure could create awkward situations, such as when Richard Mulcahy, Minister of Defense in the Dáil cabinet, but not the provisional government, had to quote-unquote arrange with the quote, provisional government to occupy for them all vacated military and police posts for the purpose of their maintenance and safeguarding. End quote is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. While Mulcahy did not hold an official position within the provisional government, he attended many meetings to organize the country's defense and deal with the schisming IRA. The British never understood this arrangement, but were forced to accept it, even though Churchill observed that it was, quote, an anomaly unprecedented in the history of the British Empire. End quote, again, is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. Flory O'Donoghue, a Republican IRA member, described the dual government as a masterstroke by the pro-treaty side. He argued that by keeping the Dáil around, the provisional government draped itself in, quote-unquote, legitimacy, while really consolidating power, both political and military, within the provisional government itself, thus neutering the republic. He claimed that, quote, if Dáil Éireann had been extinguished by the vote on the treaty, the issue would have been much more clear-cut, and many of the subsequent efforts to maintain unity would have taken a different direction. Despite Republican hopes, time was on the side of the pro-treaty party. And a quote is from Green Against Green by Michael Hopkinson. P.S. O'Hadrady, who was on the pro-treaty side, however, felt that the provisional government was a disaster for the pro-treaty side, revealing a weak government eager to appease an intransient opposition. Similarly, Griffith warned that a dual government would create chaos. What actually happened was that the Dáil existed in name and basically merged with the provisional government by the time of the general election in June. Part 1A, the National Army. So we're going to dive real deep into the National Army, the IRA, the neutral IRA in the next episode. That's going to be dedicated to just the schisms within the IRA, but this is just a brief overview. So the provisional government created the National Army on January 21st, 1922, even though legally it wouldn't be formally recognized by the Irish Free State government until August 1923. The National Army structure was based on the British Army, and it employed many men who had served in the British Army to help with organization and discipline. However, it used the IRA ranks until January 1923, when it switched to a ranked system that is utilized by most armies. The National Army got most of its equipment, uniforms, and ammunition from the British government. Once the treaty was signed, the British government was invested in preserving the Irish Free State. They even offered to send troops to help curb the Civil War. About half of the National Army were half-trained troops thrown into counterinsurgency work. The army would have issues with ill discipline and human rights violations. Many in the National Army had combat experience but little administration, training, and logistical experience. It wasn't like the IRA did properly train or equip their forces during the Irish War of Independence. However, core units such as the Dublin Guard proved themselves disciplined and effective military units. The Dublin Guard was a mixture of IRA veterans loyal to Collins, many who came from the squad, Collins's group of assassins, and ex-Royal Dublin Fusiliers who were known for their brutality in County Kerry. Their commander, Brigadier Paddy Daly, who once served as officer commanding of the squad, said, quote, "Nobody had asked me to take kids' gloves to Kerry, so I didn't." As the army grew, it relied on men with British Army experience, such as General W.R.E. Murphy, Major General Dalton, while Lieutenant General J.J. O'Connell and Major General John Prowse served in the U.S. Army during World War I. This reliance on men with ex-military experience, particularly British military experience, would cause problems for Richard Mulcahy and William Cosgrave during and after the Civil War. The provisional government knew they couldn't rely on the army to keep civil order, so they created the Civic Guards to replace the withdrawn British Army and RICs, Royal Irish Constabularies. They played a small role in the Civil War itself, except for a mutiny later in 1922, which we'll talk about in another episode. Finally, the British withdrew all forces except for 5,000 men under General Macready, who was there, Churchill claimed, because, quote, "We shall certainly not be able to withdraw our troops from their present position until we know that the Irish people are going to stand by the treaty. Neither shall we be able to refrain from stating the consequences which would follow the setting up of a republic." End quote is from Green Against Green by Michael Hopkinson. The British, either sensing the Civil War was imminent or simply being racist and assuming the Irish quote-unquote couldn't rule themselves, constantly pestered the provisional government to do a better job at governing. While they acknowledged that to interfere in Irish affairs before the Irish Free State was created would only exasperate things, they had no problem threatening the provisional government with the return of British forces whenever they didn't respond as quickly as the British expected. They had some right to be concerned, as the National Army was weak, and Collins seemed to spend more time arming the IRA in Northern Ireland than defeating the rebelling IRA in the rest of Ireland, and we'll get into that in a later episode. It's estimated that about 60 to 70% of the IRA disapproved of the treaty, while others supported it simply because Collins said to. This left Mulcahy with the difficult task of keeping together a Republican army that didn't respect or acknowledge the powers of the provisional government and felt that the Dáil was being co-opted. We'll get into this more in the next episode, but by February 1922, the provisional government was facing the unsettling truth that the National Army was in a race with the IRA to claim ownership of the abandoned British barracks and large swaths of the country. Part 2b, the handing over of Dublin Castle. The provisional government gained its first victory on January 16th, just 2 days after its creation, when Michael Collins took the keys for Dublin Castle from the British. For centuries, Dublin Castle had served as a citadel for British forces and one of the most distinct symbols of British colonial rule. The fact that it was now in Irish hands was maybe the first true sign that Ireland was free of British control. The Times described the moment as follows, quote, "All Dublin was agog with anticipation. From early morning, a dense crowd collected outside the gloomy gates in Dame Street, though from the outside little can be seen of the castle, and only a few privileged persons were permitted to enter its grim gates. At 1:30, members of the provisional government went in a body to the castle, where they were received by Lord Fitzalan, the Lord Lieutenant." Mr. Michael Collins produced a copy of the treaty on which the acceptance of his provisions by himself and his colleagues was endorsed. The existence and authority of the provisional government were then formally and officially acknowledged, and they were informed that the British government would be immediately communicated with in order that the necessary steps might be taken for the transfer to the provisional government of the powers and machinery requisite for the discharge of its duties. The Lord Lieutenant congratulated, expressed the earnest hope that under their auspices the ideal of a happy, free, and prosperous Ireland would be attained. The proceedings were held in private and lasted for 55 minutes, and at the conclusion, the heads of the principal administrative departments were presented to the members of the provisional government. Later that day, Collins would issue the following telegram. The members of the provisional government of Ireland received the surrender of Dublin Castle at 1:45 p.m. today. It is now in the hands of the Irish nation. For the next few days, the function of the existing departments of the institution will be continued without in any way prejudicing future actions. Members of the provisional government proceed to London immediately to meet the British Cabinet Committee to arrange for the various details of handing over. A statement will be issued by the provisional government tomorrow in regard to its intentions and policy. Michael Collins, Chairman. As monumental as the victory was, it did little to ease the many issues facing the provisional government. They were responsible for taking the executive from the British, maintaining public order during the transition, drafting a constitution, preparing a general election, and preventing a civil war, all while winning over their furious anti-treaty colleagues who refused to acknowledge the provisional government or the Dáil as a legitimate government. As much shit as the provisional government and later the Cosgrave administration gets, and as much as I will give, because, wow, they've made some atrocious and horrible decisions, I think it can be easy to overlook what they were facing and how overwhelmed they must have been. Many of the members of the provisional government had either been violent rebels since 1916 or had been ministers in an illegal ministry risking arrest and death since 1916. They didn't have any real government experience, they hadn't dealt with any of their traumas, and the tools that had worked for them in the past were not necessarily the best tools when they were trying to build a nation state. Another thing to keep in mind, because this will be an undercurrent to the entire war, is the relationship between the IRA and the IRB and the Dáil. In season 1, I spent a lot of time analyzing the tension between Cathal Braidir's civilian Ministry of Defense and Mulcahy and Collins's more militant squad and IRA, as well as the limited control GHQ actually had over its own units. The culture of might make mates right and violence is okay if Collins says it is one of the reasons the Civil War occurred and will plague Ireland for a long time. It was up to the provisional government to handle this problem, but how can the provisional government do that when it's run by Michael Collins, a bit of a strong man himself, who never had issues with assassinations, disappearances, and violent solutions to irritating problems? I find this quote from Kevin O'Higgins, capturing the feeling of the provisional government in 1922, both moving and enlightening. He wrote that the provisional government was, quote, simply 8 young men in the city hall standing amongst the ruins of one administration with the foundations of another not yet laid and with wild men screaming through the keyhole. Quote is from Diarmuid Fearachtar, A Nation and Not a Rabble. Part 2, the anti-treaty side. For the anti-treaty side, the acceptance of the treaty and the creation of the provisional government was nothing short of the very betrayal of everything they had fought for, both in 1916 and during the Irish War of Independence. Worse, the anti-treaty side saw the provisional government co-opting the many institutions that were supposed to belong to the quote-unquote Irish Republic, such as the Dáil, Sinn Féin, and the Irish Republican Army. In an attempt to buy time to win over more people to the pro-treaty side and to work a compromise that would prevent civil war, Collins, during a Sinn Féin meeting, delayed the general election from February to June. On one hand, this could be seen as a pragmatic thing to do, especially if he feared he didn't have the votes to uphold the treaty and prevent war with Britain, and he thought he could legitimately find a compromise that would satisfy everyone. However, many anti-treatyites saw this as election rigging. Mary McSweeney ruefully wrote, "When Collins saw he had a majority against him, he put up the unity plea to stave off the vote." Quote is from Green Against Green by Michael Hopkinson. Many anti-treatyites blamed De Valera for agreeing to this compromise. Kathleen O'Connell, De Valera's secretary, wrote of the meeting where the compromise took place, quote, "The vast majority were Republicans. What a pity a decision wasn't taken. We could start a new Republican Party clean. Delays are dangerous. Many may change before the Ard Fhealis meets again." End quote is from Green Against Green by Michael Hopkinson. The thing was that no one wanted a civil war. Collins was desperate to prevent a military conflict, and he believed that if he could craft a constitution before the next election, he could prove that the treaty was only a stepping stone meant to placate the British. The constitution would be closer to a Republican ideal. Similarly, De Valera, who even during the Irish War of Independence disliked guerrilla warfare, wanted to avoid war. He believed he could use the next 3 months to win over the provisional government and tweak the treaty itself. Sinn Féin fell apart shortly after the treaty was ratified, and De Valera created his own party that proved to be short-lived. Despite wanting compromise, De Valera went on the offensive as he campaigned for the upcoming general election, claiming on March 18, 1922, that the IRA would have to, quote, wade through Irish blood, the blood of the soldiers of the Irish government, and perhaps the blood of some of the members of the government to achieve Irish freedom. Quote is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. The developing split wasn't just a matter of semantics or principles. This was a clear divide between those who were willing to work with what they managed to wrangle from the British and those who wanted to fight until all of their goals were achieved. These goals included complete separation from Britain, a return to a glorified Gaelic past, and an Irish Republic, not a parliament that swore its loyalty to a British king. If the provisional government saw themselves as the protectors of Ireland's future, the anti-treaty side saw themselves as the protectors of Ireland's Republican past. They draped themselves in the rhetoric and principles of Easter Rising, believed that the Dáil under De Valera was the last legitimate government in Ireland, and that they alone had Ireland's true interests at heart. I want to save the in-depth discussion about the IRA's feelings for the next episode, where we talk about the taking of Barracks and the Army Convention, but the Army's growing disgruntlement and anger with everything political, its disrespect for the Dáil and GHQ, and its firm belief that it won the war and thus had a right to determine Ireland's future, also played a huge role in sparking the Civil War. The Civil War was both a legitimate political argument, but also a huge army mutiny. In his magnificent book, Vivid Faces, R.F. Foster explains the treaty split in class terms. He writes that one can see the Irish Civil War as a long brewing divide between those who were influenced by Catholic piety and social conservatism and pragmatism against those who were ardently revolutionary and radical and socialist. Liam Mellows himself argued that, quote, "We do not seek to make this country a materially great country at the expense of its honor. We would rather have this country poor and indigent. We would rather have the people of Ireland eking out a poor existence on the soil as long as they possess their souls, their minds, and their honor." End quote is from R.F. Foster's book, Vivid Faces. This sounds great and noble on paper, but how do you sell that to a people who have been colonized, gone through a world war, and spent the last few years in a guerrilla war? Ireland had been economically, physically, socially, and culturally brutalized during the Irish War for Independence, and it makes sense that while some people would want to fight until everything they desired was accomplished, others simply wanted a break and a chance to recover and heal. But even healing was a matter of contention, because what did healing really mean when you still had an oath of loyalty to your colonizer, when your national army was being armed by your former oppressor so you could fire on the disgruntled members of your own society, when your island was split in two and the only way to unite it was still through violent intervention, when so many of the heady promises made during the revolutionary period were put aside for more practical concerns. I would also add that there is something that happens when people are presented with the opportunity to form a state. We saw this in our season 2, Central Asia, during the Russian Civil War. The minute the Jadids, Alash Orda, Soviets, and others were given the chance to form their own definition of their borders and identities is the moment we see this idea of us versus them and the other forms, as well as the concept of elites who control political and economic power. The treaty shifted the debate that was occurring in Ireland during the Irish War of Independence. No longer were the IRA fighting a guerrilla war that they could lose at any moment, and they needed lofty ideals such as a republic and a free Gaelic Ireland, or an Ireland cleansed of all British influence. The treaty gave the people of Ireland a real, tangible chance to build something, and that changed a lot of desires, hopes, and plans for a lot of people. On the other hand, though, the anti-treaty side were not wild people who wanted to destroy simply to destroy, or like overly principled, naive people. They had legitimate cause to believe that a quote-unquote republic was being betrayed, that their former comrades were giving up on their dreams and goals for a compromise that really sought The split tore them apart. Many simply couldn't understand how their comrades could give up on their Republican dreams so easily. Many anti-treatyites wrote and spoke to their pro-treaty friends, begging them to support the quote-unquote republic. Mary McSweeney, one of the most vehemently anti-treaty women, wrote to none other than Richard Mulcahy, claiming, "No matter what good things are in the treaty, are they worth all this unhappiness, Dick? Do you not realize we hold the Republic as a living faith, a spiritual reality stronger than any material benefits you can offer? Cannot give it up. It is not we who have changed, it is you." Quote is from R.F. Foster's book, Vivid Faces. Formerly close family members found themselves bitterest of enemies. For example, the Ryans family found themselves torn apart as Min, Mulcahy's wife, along with Agnes and Dennis McCullough, supported the treaty while their siblings Phyllis, Chris, Nell, James, and Mary Kate were against it. Some would spend time in jail and even go on hunger strike, while Mulcahy, who was Minister of Defense, refused to release them or give in to their demands during the war. Phyllis, at one point, told Min to leave Mulcahy, but Min refused. The treaty nearly ruined Mabel and Desmond Fitzgerald's marriage and shattered friendships, the most famous being between Michael Collins and Harry Bolin. Others, like Liam Lynch, bent themselves into pretzels, trying to find a way to avoid a split. Both sides appealed to the Catholic Church to support their side as they grew closer and closer to war. Others couldn't find it in themselves to blame their comrades and turned their anger on the British, Protestants, and the quote-unquote other. Muriel McSweeney, wife to Terence, wrote to Mulcahy, who was Terence's best man at their wedding, stating, quote, "I don't feel anything against anybody but England for what has happened, although I think this treaty is by a long way the greatest infamy that the enemy has ever perpetrated against on us, and I will always oppose it or anything like it. I feel nothing against any Irishman. The whole weight of my venom is directed against the English people. I shall spend my life not, as up to this, working for the complete independence of Ireland's Republic, but also working for the destruction and downfall of England and of every single English person I come across. The English people are to me now a plague of moral lepers." Quote is from R.F. Foster's book, Vivid Faces. We'll talk about like what targeting the British meant for the Irish Protestants and Northern Ireland in another episode, but I think it's pretty obvious. It wasn't anything good. Finally, I would argue that trauma played a huge role in the split and the Civil War. You simply can't take a majority of young men and women who have spent the last few years fighting to survive and tell them to use this new political process to register their disagreements with this government that they're building on the fly. The sense of betrayal on both sides was very real and very vivid, and there wasn't any mechanism to deal with it. For the provisional government, they couldn't believe their comrades were willing to risk their very state, friendships, and lives over something as quote-unquote minuscule as an oath. The hatred of the treaty and the government that followed must have also felt quite personal, since so many former members of De Valera's government transferred to the provisional government. People had trusted them to lead the IRA, to protect each other during the War of Independence, and now all of a sudden they couldn't be trusted to lead Ireland into a liberated future. For the anti-treaty side, apparently everything they had fought for was a lie, and the comrades they thought they could trust were traitors to the very idea of an Irish Republic. Old festering personal clashes rose to the surface with sudden ferocity, because the treaty released the pressure of the War of Independence. All the differences and issues that had been developing during the Irish War of Independence could have been ignored as long as survival was paramount. But now that the war was over, the pressure that kept all of that stuff down was gone, and the world isn't any better, right? In fact, it looks like it's either going to be more of the same, or a compromised reality which doesn't really justify all the crap that the Irish had gone through to get to this point. It's, for me, it really feels like when you're working on your own trauma and you dive really deep and you accidentally ram headfirst into a deep, dark trauma, and now it's out and all these emotions your brain was trying to protect you from rise to the surface, and now you're a swirling tornado of emotions with no tools to handle it and nothing seems to help and you just want to destroy things. That seems to really be the energy of the arguments over the treaty and even as they're leading to a civil war. And we're going to talk more about the efforts that so many people took to prevent war. Even Richard Mulcahy, who had become this infamous bastard of the Irish Civil War because of his support of executions. And Liam Lynch, who led the anti-treaty IRA and died for his cause, even they worked so hard to try and prevent this war. Collins did everything he could to try and prevent this war. Churchill was getting terrified because Collins was just refusing to deal with the rising violence in Ireland and the rise of the anti-treaty IRA members. Churchill was just like, we gotta do something. But Collins did not want to fight. De Valera didn't want to fight. Even Liam Lynch didn't want to fight. You had a lot of diehards. And like, once Mary McSweeney was angry at you, she was angry at you forever. But there's no, like, no one was like purposely wanting to kill each other. It just came out of the sense of hurt and betrayal. And I really think trauma. And I think that's the biggest tragedy. It's just that even though both sides tried so hard to avoid war, it wasn't enough. The sense of betrayal was too strong, and the promised achievements of the treaty were too minuscule. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can listen to my full catalog on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, anywhere else where you listen to your podcasts, and my website, www.samswarroom.com. Please join my Patreon at www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare and help me reach my goal of 30 patrons by the end of the year. Until next time, wear a mask, organize your community, and stay safe.